This is Radio Prague, the English language service of Czech radio, with me, Jan Wellinger. Welcome to weekend programming here on Radio Prague. Here's what we have coming up for you today, a very nice program. We're going to start things with another edition of Czech Books, a new edition with David Vaughan. In just a moment, he'll be talking to author Martin Reiner, whose novel Básník, or Poet, has recently received two major Czech literary awards. After that, we're going to have the second part of our series, An American Foodie Goes to Prague, and we're going to round things up with another edition of Czech History with Jan Richter and The Social Agent, exposing Czech writer Jiří Mucha as a secret police agent. That's all ahead. Now first, though, Czech books. It is not often that one book receives two major Czech literary awards within a few weeks, but that is just what happened at the end of last year in the case of Martin Reiner's documentary novel Básník, in English Poet. In November, the book won the Josef Škvorecký Prize, and then a month later it went on to be voted Lidové noviny's Book of the Year. The novel is the culmination of nearly 30 years' research into the life of one of the great Czech poets of the 20th century, Ivan Blatný. David Vaughan talks to Martin Reiner about the book.
We have talked about the poet Ivan Blatný in this program on several occasions, and I already knew that the Brno poet and novelist Martin Reiner had a long fascination with Blatný. So I was delighted when he completed his long-planned magnum opus on the poet's life and work. In just under 600 pages, this documentary novel takes us from the pre-war literary life of Brno at the time of Blatný's childhood and youth to the series of psychiatric hospitals in Britain, where the poet spent the last decades of his life. Blatný was one of the first writers to flee Czechoslovakia after the communist takeover in 1948. But not long afterwards, he had a nervous breakdown and spent the rest of his life in various psychiatric institutions in Britain. He died in Colchester General Hospital in 1990. But he did not stop writing poetry. In Czech, English, and often a quirky combination of the two. Before we go over to my conversation with Martin Reiner, here is a recording made by Ivan Blatný's cousin, Jan Šmarda, in which the poet is reading one of his own poems in English. This is back in 1978, when he was a patient in St. Clement's Hospital, Ipswich.
The Count left the castle and went to the township bustle, tired of loneliness. Tired of Deer Park walking, he wants some more noise, more talking, tired of playing chess. And when he has enough of klaxons, of motor cars, of taxis, he's glad and turns round. Again the relaxation, above the lower nation, lucky we have a count.
Ivan Blatný himself reading his poem The Count back in 1978. Martin Reiner has spent the best part of 30 years researching into the poet's life, both before and after exile. And in the book, he does a wonderful job of putting Blatný's poetry into the context of his friendships with other Czech poets of the time. They include Vítězslav Nezval, František Halas, and Jiří Orten, all of whom have their place in the pantheon of Czech poetry. And with poignancy and telling detail, Reiner also maps each phase of Blatný's forgotten decades in exile. But at the time when he first heard about the poet, in the mid-1980s, the slightest mention of Blatný in communist Czechoslovakia was taboo. So when we met in Prague's Café Louvre, I asked him how he came to Ivan Blatný in the first place.
I was 21 and I came back to my hometown after a decade.
Your hometown is Brno.
It's Brno. And it's the hometown of Ivan Blatný too, of course. Well, I wrote poetry, and I knew virtually nobody in the city of my childhood. And as I can remember, urgently I wanted to change it. And then suddenly I met Ivan Blatný, of course not personally, but I fell upon his name, and there was something very strange about it.
And this was still during the period of communism, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was maybe 1985, 86.
When Blatný's work was completely forbidden in Czechoslovakia.
Completely erased from the Czech literary history and from the bookshelves, and there was no Blatný at all. And yeah, that was a strange thing because at the high school I was quite good in Czech literature. I even had my school leaving examination with an A, and I never heard this name before, never. And then I was sent to a guy who lended me melancholic works, which is Melancholické procházky, which is the second book of Ivan Blatný.
It's a collection of poems that he published actually during the time of the occupation, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. It was for the first time it was published in 1941, when he was 21, 22. And, well, this book, it was stunningly beautiful poetry. And in a context of this particular time, it felt like an apparition. It was something totally different from anything you could read from the Czech poetry.
While rain went rippling out across the land, you shivered at a table, blank and alone. The downpour drummed on all that black outspanned by umbrellas, the hours edged on. Far from people, far from their strange ways, their tedious good cheer and useless prattle, the wind waltzed scattering hailstones and staves above the city, and all the windows rattled. A train wheezed in just now, your train, your back, in the old country from travelling about. The inrush left boats bobbing in its wake and drizzle on the clouded station mouth. And drizzle, drizzle on the gasometer's drum, on the shunting car, on a soft grey scarf wound round. A friend is somewhere there. You always come, again to him through cold space swept by wind.
I put the pipe in a corner of my mouth and I disguised as a Sherlock Holmes, and it took quite a time to learn more about this hidden and forbidden poet. Ivan Blatný gave me for some time of my life something like meaning of the life, and he gave me sense of an adventure.
And after the fall of communism, your interest in Ivan Blatný didn't go away. You continued to be maybe even slightly obsessed with him.
Yeah, there was no reason to stop my interest after the Velvet Revolution.
Right after the fall of communism, Martin Rainer was able to travel to Britain, and he managed to visit Ivan Blatný in an old people's home in Clacton-on-Sea in Essex. It was just a brief visit, and by that time Blatný was already very frail and sick. They talked a little, but Martin realised that he had probably arrived just a little too late. Not long afterwards, the poet died, but Martin remained fascinated. He gathered vast amounts of research.
After many, many years, I decided to write a novel about him, to put together everything I knew.
And everything you know is a lot, and the novel is thick.
Yeah, it
is. Tell me more about it.
Well, I'm not quite sure, but maybe it's a so-called documentary novel. I didn't want to invent his life. I only wanted to describe it, put the facts together and put it in the book. But on the other side, I wanted to make it easily readable, to give it style. I wanted to make it a real literature, put a lot of emotions in it, make a strong piece about weak men in the maelstrom of 20th century.
You say a strong piece about a weak man, but in a sense, Blatný is strong, isn't he? Because despite all he went through and spending 40 years in various asylums, he didn't stop writing poetry, and very good poetry.
Yeah, that's probably the strangest thing about him, because he actually, in the usual way of understanding it, he was weak. Man. He was a really weak man because he was never able to face the world around him the way like most of us do. He quite often just ran away, which is the case of his stays in the institutions and in the hospitals where he spent more than 30 years in England. But yeah, you're right that all this weakness showed to be a strength, because at the end you can see him as a winner. Because he was poet. He wanted to be poet since he was 6 or 7. And when he died at his 70s, he still was poet. And he was considered to be a great poet, one of the best Czech. poets, then probably, well, he was strong enough to win this battle.
I think it was his cousin, Pavel Blatny, the composer, who said that Ivan was only a poet. He was just a poet. He was nothing else. It was everything.
Yeah, and that's why the book is called Poet. I could choose from many other names, and then I decided to choose the simplest one, just Poet, because it's him. And it's a sort of a definition of this institution. What does it mean to be a poet? The answer is in the book. Live the life the way Ivan Blatny did.
And now you've finished the book, it's published. Is that the end of Ivan Blatny for you, or do you think he's going to come back again to haunt you?
In some way it is the end, and not the end of my interest. But all the interest was sort of fulfilled with this book. I said everything I could, everything I knew, I put it in the book. But you can imagine that now we'll probably start new period of my connection with Ivan Blatny, because not all people knew who I was in relation with Ivan Blatny. And now they will know it. And they probably will call me to talk about him and stuff like this. And of course, I'm prepared to do that.
Martin Rainer, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you.
Been listening to Checkbooks with David Vaughan here on weekend programming at Radio Prague. He was talking there to the author Martin Rainer. Now, though, we continue with our series An American Foodie Goes to Prague. Hallie Crane has that.
After a few weeks of sampling Czech delicacies, such as svíčková and fried cheese, newcomers to Prague may be in the mood for something a little different, something spicier and a bit more on the colorful side. My advice is to trek down to the far southeast of the city to a district called Libuche. Here you will find a huge Vietnamese marketplace known as Sapa. I've never been to Vietnam, but the mass of stalls selling both food and all kinds of wholesale and retail items carries a distinctive, traditionally Asian flavor. The endless compartmented shopping units span a space the size of several sports fields. Stores sell everything from clothing to spices to fish to home decor. But for me, the aromas coming from the food stalls are the greatest attraction. As soon as these Asian smells hit my nose, I begin to salivate. Standing here, I feel like I've been transported to some faraway land, certainly nothing like historical Baroque Prague. As I walk around the vast Sapa complex, I see Vietnamese merchants not only trading, but also cooking meals mostly intended for their fellow Vietnamese workers. There are pots bubbling over with some kind of stock. There are large steamers and fluffy buns containing unknown delicious contents. What to choose? I decide to follow my nose. A visitor to the Czech Republic may be surprised to learn that Vietnamese form the third largest minority in the Czech Republic. Over the past few years, that country's cuisine appears to have finally won over a great number of fellow Czechs. While eateries offering pho, a Vietnamese soup, can now be found all over Prague, the real enthusiasts will make the effort to experience the freshest ingredients straight from the source. Sapa is where such ingredients arrive from the rest of the world before being distributed around the country. It's also one of the very few places where I managed to track down one of my favorite condiments, the red chili sauce known as sriracha. I always relish in the exotic thrill of picking up a bottle that doesn't have a word of English on the packaging. What a potential delicious risk to take back to your own kitchen. American chef Anthony Bourdain says that he found Sapa to be one of his favorite places in Prague. I wholeheartedly agree. There's a stimulating energy that surges through the market like nowhere else in the city. It excites the senses and offers a vibrant window on Vietnamese culture. Sapa is not only a place to eat, it is a place to learn about a different culture. I've heard that Sapa is known for the freshness and quality of its ingredients, some of which cannot be found anywhere other than Vietnam. Officially, it's a little more than a depot, serving as a distribution center for Vietnamese and other Asian goods. But it has grown into something far more vibrant than that. During my visit, I made sure to stock up on the most unusual items I can find, including a variety of odd-smelling spices and colorful Vietnamese candies. Walking through the market, I came across a man searing a pile of pig feet with a giant blowtorch. He did not permit that I take a photograph, but it was sure a sight to see. I also saw a group sitting by a pot of some delicious-smelling substance, playing poker. It may seem like an alien world at times, but there is no need for alarm. It is the soul of this place that made it so special. Sitting on the outskirts of Prague, I imagine this market is nowhere near as bustling as similar traditional markets in the East. But coming from Los Angeles, I found its calmness rather appealing. Vietnamese food is also winning new devotees beyond the Czech Republic, across Europe and the U.S. So get out of your comfort zone, get your chopsticks ready, and slurp your way through Sapa, the pure joy that can come from a steaming bowl of noodles.
Hallie Crane with another edition of An American Foodie Goes to Prague. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard so far in today's program and want to send us an email, it's easy to do so, of course, by writing to english@radio.cz. Also look up more stories and news items and features at our website. Radio.cz is the address to visit. And Radio Prague is also on Facebook and on Twitter. That takes us to our main feature for this day, our final feature, I should say, and that is Czech history. British journalist Charles Lawrence first came to Prague as a child in the 1950s. His father, a diplomat, served at the UK embassy here and brought his family with him. In the spy-ridden communist country at the height of the Cold War, he was soon targeted by the secret police. And 50 years later, Charles Lawrence revisited Prague in search of what really happened. In his book, The Social Agent, A True Intrigue of Sex, Lies, and Heartbreak Behind the Iron Curtain, he exposes Czech writer and family friend Jiří Mucha as a man who spied on his father and whose actions had very tragic consequences for his whole family. Jan Richter has that.
Charles Lawrence was 7 years old when he arrived in Prague in November 1957 with his parents and a little sister. His father, a promising diplomat at the British Foreign Office, was posted to communist Czechoslovakia after serving in Greece and Italy. Charles Lawrence, now a US-based journalist, still remembers the atmosphere of the city.
We thought of it as a mysterious and dangerous and spooky place from the get-go, because that's kids pick up the atmosphere. And the impression of the border guards and the whole thing with the passports. And at the same time, as I try and describe right away in the book, there was this confluence of the kind of comic books you're reading as a schoolboy in England or anywhere in the world in the 50s with sort of Nazis and, you know, Stalinist troops and these sort of background things you pick up in a weird way. And there it is in front of you. You know, there's this guy with jackboots.
In Prague, Charles' parents became regulars at various functions held by members of the decimated high society, which, however, still existed despite nearly a decade of communist rule. One of the stars of the elite circles of Prague was certainly Jiří Mucha, the son of the famed Czech Art Nouveau painter Alfons Mucha, a man who had travelled the world and a former war reporter for the BBC. He also spent 4 years in a communist prison, from which he was released 2 years before the Lawrence's arrival.
My father liked him as a man. I think I quote him in the book as saying he was an interesting and likeable chap in some ways and very entertaining. And he also made a big impression on me, partly because it was an unhappy family, that in an odd way I grew up at a time when I didn't want to be the kind of English person I was born to be. And he was almost a role model. I became a journalist. That persona of the world traveller with his cigarette and his anecdote and his kind of his cool made a pretty profound impression on a kid who maybe met him half a dozen times. But then his shadow kind of fell over the family.
After the fall of communism and after Jiří Mucha's death, it became clear that the worldly man who often hosted the Lawrences at his summer retreat had a dark side to him. He was recruited by Czechoslovakia's secret police, the STB, shortly after his release from prison. Taking advantage of his connections and excellent social skills, the secret police used Jiří Mucha as a social agent. His role was to seduce the wives of Western diplomats, which made it possible for the STB to blackmail them.
What you remember from a child is vague things, shadowy things, impressions. Then some specific moments, which can also, as I think everybody knows, can be distorted in memories, but normally contain a kernel of truth. the information, the simple information that Jerzy Mucha had an affair with my mother was not at issue. That was known. The consequences of that were much more interesting, and whether he himself, what his role was an issue that I grew up with. It was an issue.
Charles's father informed his superiors at the Foreign Office of the affair, which his son says effectively brought his diplomatic career to a stall.
The consequences to my family were grievous because of the affair. My understanding of it, the British security forces were extremely interested and alarmed by what had happened, and essentially my father's career was sidelined. My dad was basically a very successful man in the 50s when he was here, and up until that point he was considered a kind of star of the diplomatic service. He could have, like Christopher Malaby, who comes into the book later, he could have been the top diplomat, and his career flattened out. And my understanding now is that clearly MI5 were investigating the whole affair and what had happened and whether security had been breached. I now know, and this I had no idea of at the time, is at that time they were actually looking for the famous third man.
When Charles Lawrence returned to Prague to do research for his book, he discovered that as a secret agent, Jerzy Mucha could have played a much higher game than that, a game that might have reached the top of the political establishment in the United Kingdom.
I had no idea that this was a man who'd seduced Pauline Grant, you know, choreographer who was the mistress of the British foreign minister. I mean, you couldn't have a bigger coup as a spy. I mean, this is a James Bond, cartoon James Bond, you know. So that sort of stuff took me completely by surprise. The deviousness was kind of what I expected. The other case, I mean, one other questions that I couldn't answer, sadly, one of them was he working for both sides at once? My assessment is that he was working for sides alternatively, as it suited him, because he just worked for himself. He was always about himself, and as I say in the book, he did whatever it took. Whatever it took was, by some people's moral compass, unacceptable, and by others, maybe acceptable. And also, he did this not just to survive, but also to maintain a lifestyle.
But the affair between Charles's mother and Jerzy Mucha had a more dire consequence. During the family's stay in Prague, Charles's sister Kate started to suffer from anorexia, from which she never recovered, and died in an assisted living facility in England many years later. Her death made Charles look in what really happened in Prague and seek an answer to the question whether Jerzy Mucha was also responsible for the devastating disease that killed Charles's sister.
It's one of those stories where it's very deep, and we all have this. There may be some people who don't, but probably most people have these great scars they carry, and they go on with life, and they do what they can. And then I don't think it's uncommon for them to resurface later. And I should imagine that was probably the trigger. And the other thing that changed is that I got to know my father much better as I got older. Although I was living in New York by then, we come over once a year, and I found I would have conversations with him that I hadn't had the opportunity to have as an adolescent or as a young man, and we kind of understood each other better. And little things, dynamics with my own family, is that, rather to my surprise, he was nice with my kids, having been a very remote father to his own. He welcomed and was affectionate towards my children in a way that I found very redemptive in him.
The Czech translation of Charles Lawrence's book, which came out last month, has received much publicity. Some people were shocked by the allegations. Others said Charles's account was one-sided and unfair to the writer. The Mucha family was angered when the book first came out in English, and in fact managed to stop its second edition from being published in the United States. Jerzy Mucha's son, John, a childhood friend of Charles Lawrence, refused to comment on the account, which he called a cesspool. But Charles Lawrence says the family has a very dark past.
You know, I'm not surprised at their reaction, but as I say, I think to put it in context, this is a family with a truly dark past. It was pretty naive of me to think that they wouldn't screw me over as they screwed up everybody else. And Geraldine, as herself, is someone you can sort of almost, what's the word, admire? You know, she survived and had an extraordinary life. But again, at what cost? You know, it's, and there are details. If anyone listening wants to go and spend a few months searching the files, there are details about the family and family relations that I have not put in the book.
You've been listening to Czech History. That edition was first broadcast back in 2012. We hope you've enjoyed today's program, and be sure to join us again next time. Bye-bye. Thank you.